Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So I want to start with a reading from Scripture. This is from the book of Ecclesiastes, which is a perfect book for what I want to talk about. What profit have we from all the toil which we toil at under the sun? One generation departs, and another generation comes, but the world forever stays. The sun rises, and the sun sets, and then it presses on to the place where it rises. Shifting south and north, back and forth shifts the wind, constantly shifting its course. All rivers flow to the sea, yet never does the sea become full. To the place where they flow, the rivers continue to flow. All things are wearisome, too wearisome for words. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor has the ear enough of hearing. I, Koheleth, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my mind to search and investigate in wisdom all things that are done under the sun. A bad business God has given to human beings to be busied with. I have seen all things that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a chase after wind. So, the title of this retreat is Happiness and the Meaning of Life. And the title almost implies that, like, these are more or less the same sort of thing. And as I was thinking about what I want to talk to you guys about, well, I started to think about that, and it seems to me that, like, they're not the same thing. Question, like, happiness is something different than the meaning of life. And I think it's quite a bit easier for us to grasp what happiness is than it is for us to grasp the question, what is the meaning of life, or does life have meaning? And so I want to say something about that in this talk. So first of all, what do we mean by meaning when we say the meaning of life? Now, if you look, there's been a ton of stuff written in philosophy about this, especially in the last 30 years, 40 years. But it seems to me that the most important meaning of meaning, as it were, is that for something to have meaning is for it to have a point. For it to have, like, you know, a reason for being. You might say a justifying reason. Okay, so when we're asking whether life has meaning, what we're asking, or at least the version of the question that I'm going to look at, the version I think is most important, is the question of, does life have a point? So is having a meaningful life the same thing as having a happy life? Well, I'm going to say that no, they're not the same thing, even though they are related. I'll say more about that. It's important to distinguish that I'm not talking about here what we might call everyday meaning. Okay, so what do I mean by that? I mean, like, the reason that I go to the store, to the grocery store, is in order to get groceries. The reason that I'm playing a board game is in order to rest, connect with friends, something like this. The reason that I work is to support my family, to get money, to be able to live, or to do fun things that I want to do. Each of these are, like, you might say, projects that we engage in life, right? And we have tons of these. Our day is filled with them. And all of them seem to have meaning in the sense that I'm talking about it, right? They have a point, right? There's a reason that I'm doing these things. Okay, but the question of the meaning of life is sort of a question about ultimate meaning. What about, so each one of the things that I do there seems to be some reason that I do it, but what about the project of living? Does that have a point? So there seems to be some kind of meaning in our everyday actions, but does the project of life as a whole have meaning? So that's the question that I'm interested in. Now, there's been a lot of people that have said no to this question. And why would somebody say no to it? Well, here's something you might think. You might think that, well, like, each one of the things that I do that have meaning, their meaning is always something beyond themselves. So what do I mean? Like, I don't play a board game for the sake of playing a board game. There's something I'm getting out of it. I'm enjoying it. I'm connecting with people that I care about. If I'm caring for my children, I'm not caring for my children just for the sake of caring for my children. I'm caring for them because they have dignity. I love them. I have a responsibility for them, etc. So things sort of beyond the actual project itself. Right? The project, and it seems like this is always the case for the things that we do in life that have a point. And so this becomes puzzling when we talk about the project of life as a whole. Because it doesn't seem like the project of life has any purpose beyond itself, at least when we first look at this. So there's a long tradition of people for various reasons saying that life is not meaningful. So I'm going to give you an example of one pretty famous recent person, Thomas Nagel, who's a professor at New York University. So he speaks of this in terms of saying life is absurd. Okay, and by absurd, he means something like it has no point. So he says, and this is the example he gives to try to convince you that of this absurdity of life. He says, why is the life of a mouse, so take a mouse for example, not absurd? The orbit of the moon is not absurd either. But that involves no strivings or aims at all. A mouse, however, has to work to stay alive. Yet he is not absurd because he lacks the capacities for self-consciousness and self-transcendence that would enable him to see that he is only a mouse. If that did happen, his life would become absurd, since self-awareness would not make him cease to be a mouse and would not enable him to rise above his mousely strivings. Bringing his newfound self-consciousness with him, he would have to return to his meager yet frantic life, full of doubts that he was unable to answer, but also full of purposes that he was unable to abandon. So what's the idea here? The idea is if you had a mouse that suddenly got self-consciousness and could ask, like, what's this all about? You know, this striving for food and avoiding, you know, avoiding mouse traps, you know, trying to get the cheese without the mouse traps, mating, all the things that the mouse does and that it can't not do, right? These are just projects that come from his mousely strivings. But if the mouse had self-consciousness, it says, wait a minute, what's the point of all this? Like, why, how does my life as a mouse, like, I'm just a mouse, right? There's this whole world out there. There's a whole universe out there. There's tons of other mice out there, right? Why do I matter? And so this is the way people get this off the ground. And in fact, like, it's not that, so a lot of us, so one of the things that we'll have to think about, right, is does religion help us? Because you might think that that's just another one of our strivings, right? And that's another one of our projects, the project of obeying God, for example, of living a holy life. And how could that, you could still ask the question, right? Why does this whole project of living have meaning? Why does what gives it a point? Okay, so one question we might ask is, could meaningfulness of life be some sort of feeling? Could it have something to do with our feelings? You all have seen The Matrix, right? I know that I sometimes ask students, before I moved here last summer, I taught at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. And I would sometimes ask my students, yeah, you guys have seen The Matrix, and it wasn't always universal. And the ones who had seen it, see it. Oh, yeah, I love classic movies. Right? And I'm like, gosh, am I that old? So there's this scene in The Matrix maybe if you remember it. So there's a character in The Matrix who betrays sort of the good guys, as it were. Right? And there's a scene where he's sitting with the with one of the kind of evil computer-based guys, the one who plays Elrond, and forget his name, in The Lord of the Rings. He's got his dark glasses on. Yes, yes. What's it say again?
Aiden Smith.
Aiden Smith, yes. So he's sitting there in a restaurant inside the Matrix eating a steak, and he looks at the steak and he says, "You know, the steak is tender and juicy, but I know that it's the Matrix that's telling my mind that it's tender and juicy. And you know what? Ignorance is bliss." And he just like takes a bite of the steak, right? And then he proceeds to like betray the people outside the Matrix. And there's a theme running through that movie, right? That's trying to make us ask, well, does it matter if our experiences are the same? Does it matter whether it's real? Right? And part of the purpose of the movie is that we're supposed to think, and I think most people do think, it does matter. Like, there's a part of me that is worried about the question of whether it matters, but like it feels like it does matter. So long before The Matrix, more than 20 years before The Matrix, a philosopher named Robert Nozick at Harvard put out this thought experiment, which I think is in some ways kind of gets at kind of what you might say is the philosophical challenge of The Matrix. So Nozick says, suppose there were an experience machine that would give you an experience you desired. Super-duper neuropsychologists could stimulate your brain so that you would think and feel you were writing a great novel or making a friend or reading an interesting book. Notice that the experience machine is capable of far more than just what we call level one happiness, right? It can give you any level of happiness you want because it can give you any experience you want, right? So should you... all the time you would be floating in a tank with electrodes attached to your brain. Should you plug into this machine for life, pre-programming your life's experiences? If you're worried about missing out on desirable experiences, we can suppose that business enterprises have researched thoroughly the lives of many others. You can pick and choose from their large library or smorgasbord of such experiences, selecting your life's experiences for, say, the next 2 years. Of course, while in the tank, you won't know that you're there. You'll think it's all actually happening. Others can also plug in to have the experiences they want, so there's no need to stay unplugged to serve them. Would you plug in? So one version of this is like, for the rest of your life, just every 2 years, you wake up and you decide what your experiences will be for the next 2 years. You put them in there. And again, to be clear, right, this is a little bit different than just stimulating pleasure in your brain, because you can choose to, like, say, you know, I want to become a great football player, and I want to become a great football player through hard work, right? And you'll have the experience having to work, you know, hard day in and day out, and eventually becoming a great football player. So you can get any experience that you want. And then he asks us, well, look, this is clearly better than the life you're living now, right? Whatever life you're living now, you have problems, right? And you have problems that you didn't choose. If you want to build problems into your life in the experience machine, you can, right? Because sometimes we know overcoming difficulties can help us grow. So would you plug in? I mean, Nozick is presupposing that most people are going to... everyone's going to want to try the experience machine, right? Like, lots of people are going to want to try it. But that when you ask, should you plug in for the rest of your life, people are going to balk. It's like, well, it's not real. His point is to show us that what we want is more than just experiences. And so how does this connect with the meaning of life? Well, the meaning of life certainly can't just be experiences. Even if we could solve the problem of sort of having a meaning outside of our life, right? Experiences won't be enough for us. Okay, so in a way, this is a kind of second problem related to the problem of not being able to find a meaning for our life as a whole, but that, like, it's not experiences that what we're looking for. And a lot of us would identify experiences with happiness, right? I mean, that's like, those are pretty closely connected. And so this might also make us ask, you know, is happiness really what we want? Okay. Now, you might think that the martyrs have solved this problem. Okay? So, what have the martyrs done? They've given up worldly happiness in order to achieve a greater happiness, right? A happiness that has been promised them in heaven, the enjoyment of the vision of God. And yet, isn't that just another experience? Like, isn't the vision of God, this happiness that we look forward to, you know, and that we especially look forward to when we're suffering in this life, isn't that just another experience? And so, is it really, like, can that be the meaning of life? We start to think at some point that, like, maybe we shouldn't care whether life has meaning. Like, maybe we're wrong. Maybe actually, like, the experiences are all there is. And even all that God has to offer us. But it's, I think if you're like me, there's part of me that's like, no, that can't be right. Like, it can't be, the experience machine, like, can't be, you know, my ultimate end. Like, imagine there was a super experience machine that could even give you the kind of beatific vision, the kind of experience of God, right? The enjoyment of God that we get in heaven. Imagine there was something like that. It wouldn't be right, right? There would still be something wrong. There would be something wrong. There's something that is missing. And I do think it's something we should lose sleep over. So I actually think Thomas Aquinas has something to say about this. You might think, well, he didn't see The Matrix. He didn't see any of these movies. How could he, you know, how could he have something to tell us? But so Thomas Aquinas, when he talks about human happiness, he doesn't just say that it's the enjoyment of God. So he says, our end is twofold, our goal. First, there's the thing itself, which we desire to attain. Thus, for the miser, the end is money. Secondly, there's the attainment or possession, the use or enjoyment of the thing desired. Thus, we may say that the end of the miser is the possession of money. And so the end is money, and it's the possession of money, both for the miser. And the end of the intemperate man is to enjoy something pleasurable. In the first sense, then, man's last end is the uncreated good, namely God, who alone, by his infinite goodness, can perfectly satisfy man's will. Notice, in that first version of happiness, it's not the satisfaction of the will that's the goal. It does satisfy the will, right? But the goal is God. The second way, man's last end is something created, existing in him. And this is nothing else than the attainment or enjoyment of the last end. Now, the last end is called happiness. If, therefore, we consider man's happiness in its cause or object, then it is something uncreated. But if we consider it as the very essence of happiness, then it is something created. So here we have the first clue that there's something more to happiness than just what's created in us, our experience. There's something about something outside of us, namely God. Aquinas, so our end is something more than what we experience. So Aquinas, in another place, though, actually suggests something that's a lot like The Matrix. So get a look at this. So it's an objection. Man is made happy by that which lulls his natural desire. Okay, lulling his natural desire means satisfying all of our desires, right? That's what we hope for. But man's natural desire does not reach out to a good surpassing his capacity. Since then, man's capacity does not include that good which surpasses the limits of all creation. It seems that man can be made happy by some created good. Consequently, some created good constitutes man's happiness. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, so we are finite, right? We're limited. Therefore, our ability to enjoy anything is limited, including God, right? It's limited by our created nature. We can't know God perfectly in his essence. And even in heaven, we won't. So the objection is, what it's saying is that, like, look, if our ability if our sort of the absolute, the most we can enjoy is still finite and limited, couldn't that be provided by something finite? Why do we need God to provide, as it were, the enjoyment, the maximal enjoyment of happiness? And so here's how he responds. He says, created good is not less than the good of which man is capable. In other words, created good could. I mean, the suggestion is that the created good could fulfill us as of something intrinsic and inherent to him. So just in terms of what we can enjoy by our nature, created good is not less than that. But it is less than the good of which he is capable as of an object, and which is infinite. The object meaning it's less than the good that we are capable of enjoying external to us. So the experience, let me just finish the quote. So the participated good, which is in an angel and in the whole universe, is a finite and restricted good. So the suggestion here is that an angel, something higher than us, could theoretically give us the experiences that we want, experiences that satisfy our will. And yes, something will be missing. Why? Because there's more to happiness than just experience. Now, you might say, well, in answer to this, you might say, well, yeah, but like, this is like, so think of this angel as like the like heavenly matrix, okay? That like gives us the experience of fulfillment without the vision of God, okay? And you might say, well, just as the bad guy said in the movie, what's the difference, right? What's the difference between, if I have that experience, I don't need the vision of God. But Aquinas doesn't think that's quite right. So, is the enjoyment of the end the most important thing? So here's what he says. If one considers the matter carefully, the operation of the intellect, which is vision, must needs rank before delight. For delight consists in a certain repose of the will. Now, so resting of the will in its ultimate pleasure. Now, that the will finds rest in anything can only be on account of the goodness of that thing in which it reposes. If, therefore, the will reposes in an operation, the will's repose is caused by the goodness of the operation. Nor does the will seek good for the sake of repose. See, this is important. The will is not seeking the good for the sake of being satisfied. It's not seeking God for the sake of experience, for the sake of the happiness that results. For thus, if that were the case, the very act of the will would be the end, right? It would be its own end. This is kind of what the contemporary people like Thomas Nagel are critiquing, right? This idea that an activity is its own end, right? Activities have a point, usually, and they have something outside of them that makes them valuable. But, he says, the will seeks to be at rest in the operation because that operation is its good. Okay, so it's not seeking rest. It's not seeking the operation in order to be at rest. It rests because the operation is good. So, consequently, he says, it is evident that the operation in which the will reposes ranks before the resting of the will therein. And so what is the operation? The operation is the vision of God. And here's the thing about the vision of God. You might say, well, that's also something in us. It's not just in us, though, because it's the vision of God, right? And God is outside of us. And God is, in the vision of God, God is our ultimate good. We see him as our ultimate good. And so here's what I want to suggest. So the vision of God ranks first. The repose of the will is not the final end, rather the good itself is the final end. So what is the meaning? Here's what I want to suggest. The meaning of life is not the enjoyment of God, but the glory of God himself, concerning whom, through intellectual union with him, we can be certain that he is real and is the highest good. So this isn't like the Matrix. Right? In the immediate vision of God, we have certainty that we are united to the highest good. There's nothing that can come between that. There can't be, ultimately, a divine matrix that tricks us. Notice that the glory of God is something outside of our life. Hence, it can make our life a worthy end. Sorry, a little typo there. Because it's outside of us, it's capable of making our life a worthy end. And notice, too, that since God is ultimate truth, once we see him, we cannot doubt that he is the highest good and that his glory is the only possible point of our life. Okay, I want to end with a more kind of speculative question. But this is still speculative anyway, actually. But this is me here. This is not in the catechism. But the question I want to end with is this. Could one have a meaningful life without happiness? Is it possible that you could have a meaningful life without happiness? Now, it seems like at least certain kinds of happiness you could have without meaning. But ultimate happiness, if it's what Aquinas says it is, right? If it involves not just the enjoyment of God, but first and foremost, the vision of God in its nature and union with him. That if that's what gives life meaning, that's also happiness. But the question I'm asking now is, could you have meaningful life without happiness? If meaningful life depends upon the glory of God. And I guess what I want to leave you with is this quote from Thomas More. This comes from the Office of Readings for his feast day. This is a letter he wrote from the Tower of London as he's waiting for a judgment on his case to his daughter. He says, "Although I know well, Margaret, that because of my past wickedness, I deserve to be abandoned by God, I cannot but trust in his merciful goodness. His grace has strengthened me until now and made me content to lose goods, land, and life as well, rather than to swear against my conscience. God's grace has given the king a gracious frame of mind toward me, so that as yet he has taken from me nothing but my liberty. In doing this, his majesty has done me such great good with respect to spiritual profit that I trust that among all the great benefits he has heaped so abundantly upon me, I can count my imprisonment the very greatest. I will not mistrust him, Meg. Though I shall feel myself weakening and on the verge of being overcome with fear, I shall remember how St. Peter, at a blast of wind, began to sink because of his lack of faith, and I shall do as he did, call upon Christ and pray to him for help. And then I trust he shall place his holy hand on me and in the stormy seas hold me up from drowning. And finally, Margaret, I know this well, that without my fault, he will not let me be lost. I shall therefore with good hope commit myself wholly to him, and if he permits me to perish for my faults, then I shall serve as praise for his justice. But in good faith, Meg, I trust that his tender pity shall keep me, my poor soul, safe and make me commend his mercy." So it's a very powerful reading, actually. I cut some of it out. It's one of my favorite readings of the year because it's so tender, him writing to his daughter. But what I want to point out here is what it says at the end there. "If he permits me to perish for my faults, I shall serve as praise for his justice." There is a sense in which Thomas More is trusting in God. He's not doubting that God has his back. At the same time, he also is not presumptuous. But that doesn't shake his sense of meaning in what he's doing. Why? It has a point because even if he is damned, he will serve for the glory of God. Like his life will have been for the glory of God and the praise of God's justice. Now, it's a hard thing to think about, right? Because that's the absolute final and definitive loss of happiness. And yet, it seems like even knowing that that could be the eventuality, his life has meaning. And not because of life itself, but because of something external to it. A good that the life serves, that his life serves, that's beyond all the goods within his life. I don't know how long it's been, but that's all I have.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.